Our first guest today tells the story of a determined boy, a visionary coach, and how the dream of a record-breaking channel swim became reality. To hear the story of how an 11-year-old became the youngest person to swim the channel, welcome to the show, Tom Gregory. How are you doing, Tom?
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Very welcome. So this is you back in 1988.
Yeah, that's right. So it's actually nearly 30 years to the day since I swam from France to England. And it was on the 6th of September. And it was a total crossing of 32 miles. And on that day, I was 11.
Wow. Isn't that dangerous for a young boy?
It wasn't dangerous. I get asked that question a lot. And there are a whole load of things. And maybe which we can talk about, which sort of kept it safe. But above all, it was under the supervision of a very important coach, a swimming coach from back in the '80s in South East London, a chap called John Bullitt. And he, let's say, he just knew what he was doing.
Yeah, I know he looked after you, and he started training you 4 years prior. I believe it took 4 years to train to get that far.
That's right, yeah. So my sister and I moved with our parents to Elton, and Mum had the idea that she thought we needed another hobby. I thought we didn't. So she sent me and my big sis to the swimming club in landlocked Elton, I'll just say. And we didn't really know that it was a club that specialised in long-distance swimming and in channel swimming in particular. And the whole thing had been set up maybe 15, 18 years before by this guy, John. And so he'd kind of built this thing around him. And then over a period of, I guess, what became 4 years, you know, gradually I and he realised that an attempt on that world record was possible.
Because he'd done it before, hadn't he, Tom? He'd had success with a 12-year-old member of the club, but you were even younger than him when you did it.
And that's right, and it's an important point because, you know, I talked about him being an experienced coach. He knew what kids were capable of, and he knew what youth can achieve. And so Marcus Hooper was a guy who held the record before me. I remember vividly meeting Marcus for the first time. I'd seen his sort of photos from 1979, you know, flared trousers and what have you, on the notice board at the swimming baths, and thought, wow, I'd love to meet that guy. And I remember when John introduced him, or introduced me to him, I'd say, at a Christmas party when I was about 9. And I thought, and he was such a lovely, lovely guy, hugely impressive guy. And I thought, that's it, I've got your record.
And does your record still stand today?
It does, 30 years later.
Wow.
But I would add, it's an important point, really, that just after I made the crossing, the association that governs the sport set a rule that nobody under the age of 12 could do it, and that was really a safety thing. And that age has subsequently, in later years, gone up to 16. So
it'll never be broken.
Yeah,
you'll never get your record broken then.
No, but I have to say, for me, I wish that wasn't the case. You know, I wish it was still possible to do that. Because in a sporting sense, you know, records are there to be broken, aren't they? And the ones that are really impressive are the ones that last, you know, that stand the test of time. So my own view, and I probably would say this, wouldn't I? But, you know, I think it's a pity that ban is in place in many respects, although I'm a parent too, so I do understand why people felt it was necessary.
Yeah, I think... We're really, really massively into health and safety, aren't we, just lately? And I suppose they have to, you know, if they're putting health and safety procedures into other things, they have to think of the water as well and young boys or girls.
Yeah, that's true. And there were some circumstances back in 1988 that really forced the issue. So just about 4 weeks before I made the crossing, a Brazilian swimmer called Renata Agondi died in her attempt. And she was a world-class swimmer, and she was 24, and she died of cold.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, people say to me, oh, that couldn't happen now, and that's true. And my normal response is, well, it very nearly didn't happen there, because there was a little bit of a pause, you know, to say, okay, what else do we need to do to absolutely make this as safe as it needs to be?
Mm. And what do you do then to stop hypothermia, for example?
Well, look, I mean, the main thing is about training. And so, you know, some of your listeners might be long-distance swimmers or into endurance sport and things, and they would know that, you know, for swimming the channel, it's really about two things. It's about the distance and the cold. And for the cold, you can prepare. I didn't have a hot shower for months on months, maybe from Christmas time of 1988. I was just in cold water, if you get me. And I used to stay out of the t-shirts and just make jumpers like that. And I used to sleep with the window wide open in my small bedroom, just a bed sheet. And all of that was fine because I could just adjust to it, and I did adjust to it. I think possibly even easier for a youngster to do that than an adult, maybe. But I found that I could build a resilience to the cold. And of course, the other thing was I was pretty fat. I was quite chubby. I was fit, but I was fat. It's not often you hear that in the same sentence. But I ate a lot of food and put on lots of puppy fat.
Right.
Which, as you can imagine, is really good insulation, isn't it? So yeah.
And how did John start training with you? I mean, obviously, you start in the swimming baths, the swimming pool, I should imagine. But I think your first actual swim outside of there was at Lake Windermere?
Yeah, that's right. So John had a squad of sort of senior swimmers who he took on the sort of channel swimming journey, if that makes sense. And we used to... It was a huge adventure. Just when I think back to all the things we used to do, we used to drive down to Dover for the weekend and camp in the campsites and swim in the sea, you know, four or five times a day. And then once a year we'd head up to Windermere, which is England's longest lake, obviously, and you know, 10.5 miles long. And it can be quite a wild place, Windermere, you know, because the wind gets up and it's quite isolated in the middle. And so a really good training ground to test yourself for that kind of event. And of course, these days it's hugely popular. You know, back in the 80s, I think there was people were doing it for sure, but it was a limited number of people. And these days, open water swimming is a mass participation sport, and so much the better.
Yeah. I can't imagine getting in, when you think about the leap to the channel, actually getting in the channel, was it dark?
Yeah. I mean, I can recall this so vividly. It feels like a sort of scene from a spy novel. That we were in John's car flashing the headlamp. It was dark. It was 5 a.m. And we were flashing the headlamps of the car and waiting for a signal to come back from the boat offshore. And eventually a boat appeared in the darkness and the signal was answered. So I put my trunks on and John put the grease over me, that people that, you know about channel swimmers wear the grease on their skin. And he snapped one of those little light sticks, the sort of things you see at bonfire night, you know, and he tied it to the back of my trunks. And I hadn't seen that before. I said, oh, what's that for? He said, well, we're only swimming off in the dark, Keith Allen. You know? And I remember very clearly being on the shore at Wissant Bay in France. A lighthouse was sort of flashing occasionally. And then just on the horizon, I could see a smudge of light, which I thought, well, that's got to be Dover. You know, and I'm going to swim there. And then off into the dark sea. But I was hugely excited because I, you know, keep coming back to the point, I was prepared for it and I knew what was going to happen. And so I would, you know, there was certainly some trepidation. I was slightly concerned about what was to come. But I wasn't scared of the environment itself, and so it was a mix of trepidation and excitement, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And how does it work? Did John go behind you in the boat?
Sort of the other way around. So so John's on the boat with the crew, and I swim alongside the boat because, you know, I'm looking up to the side doing sort of front crawl. And the boat needs to know where to go, and there's a pilot on there whose job it is to, you know, to basically cross the busiest shipping lane in the world at the, you know, at 90 degrees with a swimmer, which is obviously a slow-moving vessel. So it takes a bit of thought, and then there's a lot of knowledge required to judge the tides and the way the tides wash you, you know, the wrong way. But so yeah. Tides don't go from England to France, they go the other direction. So you're always swimming at 90 degrees to a tide in one direction. So aiming that course and steering that course is the pilot's job. And the swimmer really is just kind of, you know, staying with the boat, which is setting the course effectively.
So you sort of have to, I'm trying to imagine, you sort of have to take an S shape.
Yes, That's exactly it. Right. So people would know that, you know, it's, I think it's 20 and a half or 21 miles, roughly, Cap Grenet to Dover. But I think the shortest distance that people have recorded across the channel is something like 28 miles. And my recorded distance was 32, because it bends you in an S shape, and actually the tide moves it, which is out. So, yeah.
And
that's
how...
part of the nature of the challenge of the channel, really, is the time.
Yes, of course. How long did you say it took you?
Oh, just under 12 hours. I think the clock said 11 hours and 54 minutes.
Wow, that 6 minutes makes a difference.
Time. Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds better. You must have been incredibly tired. Did you ever feel like giving up?
Frequently. And I think, again, that's maybe the third challenge. I talked about the speed and the sort of distance of the cold, but the other part of it clearly is the mental challenge. And so, yes, there was lots of moments of thinking, like, this is impossible, particularly in the early part, actually, when you think, well, maybe I've done a few miles and there's got to be another at least 20 to go, sort of thing. And I can remember very clearly the moment of getting halfway and John saying, look, we're halfway, it's 5 hours, which is great. So there's a moment of hope, and then I looked up and I caught my first glimpse of the cliffs of Dover.
Mm.
And then, of course, that for the following hours, they just never, ever seemed to get closer, which was very upsetting at the time. But, you know, that's the point. You know, endurance sport can be like that, and that's really one of the reasons why people do it, strangely. And so I won't pretend that it was all pleasant. It wasn't. But, of course, you know, afterwards, when you've done something like that, you're left with a feeling of achievement over time.
Oh, gosh, yeah, of course. And 12 hours, were you allowed to eat or have anything to drink during that time, or was it just completely swimming?
No, so what happens is they used to boil up a bit of soup. It was tomato soup, and they poured it into one of those fat, stubby tonic bottles that people might remember. I don't really see them around anymore, but in the 80s they were there. And they would pass that glass bottle over the side of the boat, and I'd swim up and grab the bottom of the bottle. And you're not allowed to touch anybody or the boat. So there's a bit of object in between you guys. And you tread water and sweep the soup, and then, you know, let the bottle sink to the bottom of the sea. And then that and the old chocolate digestive logged over the side, that was my fuel. This is the days before sports nutrition as we know it now. So, yeah.
And has it put you off tomato soup for life?
No, I still love it. It's a comfort food. Big comfort food.
And are you still doing endurance sports?
I don't regret to be. I don't really have a sort of job or anything that necessarily really allows for it. I've got two little kids, one and three, so we're still waiting for that fog to lift. So I'll never say never. I'd love to get back into something like that, but it's very time intensive. So I sort of satisfy myself with the old game of rugby and things.
And what about your children? Do you think you'll ask them if any of them want to do it? Obviously, it's got to be a higher age now because of the laws.
Yeah, I would support them if that's what they wanted to do. I think with the kids now, I try and take them when I can, and quite a lot. But all I really want for them is to enjoy the setting of the water and have the feeling of what it's like to swim, because that's what happened with me. I just loved swimming. So the training and all the distances and all those things, they kind of happened as a consequence of just what you might call raw enthusiasm, you know? So if the girls love swimming, that's great. But they would never be kind of coaxed into it by me. I just hope they have the same amount of enjoyment being in the water that I do.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Well, I think you're incredible. You were certainly incredible when you were 11, and I know that you were very close to John Bullitt. Is he still alive?
No, and well, I got the opportunity to write it all down. The sort of sad end to the book, really, is that John passed away just 4 months or 5 months after we made that crossing. And then by then I was 12, and so I was quite traumatised by that. But many of us were, you know, it wasn't just me, there was a whole club of kids and parents and families, etc., that John had built around him as his community. And so we were all very upset by it. It was a real tragedy.
Yeah,
very unexpected death. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure he'll be very proud. He'll be watching down and be very proud of you and the book. The book is called A Boy in the Water, a memoir. It's by Tom Gregory, who we're speaking to now. And it's all about the boy who broke the record swimming the channel at age 11. Thank you very much, Tom, for sharing your story, and good luck with the book.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Have a lovely day. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.